to mark the 400th anniversary of the birth of John Milton on the 9th of December 1608. Milton was a student at Christ's for 7 long years, as he put it himself, beginning with his matriculation in the Lent term of 1625 and ending with his graduation as Master of Arts in 1632. And by the way, you can see a record of his matriculation and of his petition for the MA degree, both in his own handwriting, in the spectacular exhibition of Miltoniana currently on display in the University Library. I really warmly recommend it. I mean, not now, but... After 1630s, Milton maintained no further links with Cambridge, and it must be admitted that in later life he always spoke disparagingly of the training he received here. He complains in his Reason of Church Government about the monkish and miserable sophistry encouraged by the university system of disputation, and he adds in his Treatise of Education that the curriculum generally gave rise to a hatred and contempt of learning in those subjected to it. However, Milton seems to have retained a warm affection for his college, as he makes clear in his Apology of 1642, I quote, "I am very glad to acknowledge publicly with all grateful mind that more than ordinary favour and respect which I found above any of my equals at the hands of those courteous and learned men, the fellows of that college, wherein I spent so many years." Well, I'm not sure about that last phrase, but otherwise I think the fellows of Christ have never been more elegantly thanked. And for its own part, the college has always taken great pride in its connections with John Milton, connections which may be said to extend to continuities with our own time. The specific room in which Milton lived as a student has never been definitively identified, but tradition places it in the northwest corner of the first court, and thus in the same building in which, as it happens, I wrote this lecture. Milton must certainly have visited the rooms I currently use, and I like to think of him tramping up the same attic stairs. And the rooms themselves remain very much as he would have known them. There is a dreadful modern carpet. I hope the domestic bursar is present. Well, it scarcely needs to be said that nowadays Milton is primarily remembered as a poet, as a lyric poet, perhaps chiefly for Lycidas, the early elegy commemorating the untimely death of Edward King, a near contemporary of his at Christ's. But he was also a tragic poet, the author of Samson Agonistes, first published in 1671, and above all, a writer of epic verse, the author of Paradise Regained, first published in 1671, as well, of course, as of Paradise Lost, which he composed, according to John Aubrey, his first biographer, between 1658 and 1663, and which was first published in 1667. It's more easily forgotten that Milton was also a voluminous writer in prose. He published numerous religious and political tracts throughout the period of the English Civil Wars, the period in which the monarchy and the Church of England were both abolished. These were shattering changes to the fabric of English life, and Milton wrote with passionate eloquence in support of both of them. Milton's writings as a political propagandist span exactly the revolutionary decades between 1640 and 1660, so let me say a word about that period. The year 1640 saw the reconvening of Parliament after 11 years in which King Charles I had sought to rule without having to confront its growing opposition to his fiscal and ecclesiastical policies. As soon as the two houses reassembled, they began to debate with renewed hostility the alleged misgovernment of the church and the Crown's misuse of its prerogative rights. And Milton contributes to both these arguments, beginning with a series of 5 tracts against episcopacy. The first, of Reformation, appeared anonymously in 1641, and the most important, in which Milton very boldly, for that moment, put his name upon the title page, was called The Reason of Church Government, 1642. The climax of this revolutionary decade, of the 1640s comes, of course, with the trial and the execution of King Charles I, who was publicly beheaded in 1649 on this very day, the 30th of January, which is why I chose today to talk to you. Thereupon, Parliament abolished the institution of monarchy and proclaimed England a republic, the only republic under which the English have ever lived, so far. You can see whose side I'm on. Within 2 weeks of the King's execution, Milton published his tract entitled The Tenure of Kings and Magistrates, in which he argues that free peoples retain sovereignty at all times, and thus that they have an inalienable right to sit in judgments on their rulers and, should they choose, to dispose of them, as the people of England had just disposed of the figure whom he never names but always simply calls the tyrant. Now, Milton's tenure immediately brought him to the attention of the new Council of State, dominated by Oliver Cromwell, and Milton was immediately appointed as its Secretary for Foreign Tongues, his principal duty being to translate official correspondence into Latin, still the official language of international diplomacy. But he was also given the task of writing further political propaganda, this time in defense of the new regime. This latter task was regarded as urgent, since the death of the king had brought with it a dangerously popular outpouring of royalist treatises vindicating Charles's alleged divine right to rule. By far the most influential of these works, published under the King's name, although actually written by John Gordon, chaplain later to Charles II, appearing within a week of his execution, was this text called the Icon Basiliki, the image of the King, which proved, in fact, to be one of the greatest bestsellers of 17th century English print, and it went through over 60 editions within its first year. This was very dangerous. The icon takes the form, as perhaps you know, of a narrative of Charles I's sufferings at the hands of his own parliament, but each chapter closes with a lengthy prayer, and the king is represented throughout not merely as a man of deep piety, but as a martyr, at first imprisoned and eventually murdered for his cause. Now, Milton is instructed to reply specifically to these claims, and he does so in his lengthy tract entitled Iconoclastes, that's to say, The Image Breaker, which first appeared in October 1649. Here he mounts an excoriating personal attack on the tyrant, as well as an indictment of his government, in which he replies point by point in a very disputatious university style to the king's own narrative. One of Milton's charges is that it's the merest hypocrisy to portray the king as a man of deeply religious life. The truth is that he whiled away the time of his imprisonment in reading plays. And Milton adds, in what I find a fascinating tone of disapproval, I quote, that one whom we well know was the closet companion of these his solitudes was William Shakespeare. The council was insistent that Milton should keep up this work as a propagandist, especially after the leading French royalist, Claude de Saumaise, published his Latin Defensio Regis, the defense of the king, in October of 1649, thereby causing a further crisis of legitimacy in the English Republic. Milton is instructed to reply to that, and he duly manages to respond in his Latin defensio, the defense of the English people, later that year. But he completes this work under the gravest difficulties, for this is the moment at which he finally went blind. So Mays makes a point of assuring Milton that his loss of sight, which had been failing since the mid-1640s, was God's vengeance upon him for supporting the death of the king. But Milton magnificently replies in one of his sonnets that in fact my sight was overplied in liberty's defense, my noble task. Well, the abolition of the monarchy in 1649 was proclaimed to be permanent, but it began to become clear less than a decade later that there would be a restoration, not merely of the monarchy, but of an episcopally governed Church of England as well. Milton is appalled by this prospect. And he must have stopped work on the dictation of Paradise Lost in order to dictate what are his two fiercest political polemics, in which he despairingly condemns both these probable outcomes. And in this case, the titles of the two tracts, 17th century titles, tend to be very discursive, don't they? They say it all. The first, published early in 1659, is called A Treatise of Civil Power in Ecclesiastical Causes, showing that it is not lawful for any power on earth to compel in matters of religion. And the second, which appeared exactly a year later, was called The Ready and Easy Way to Establish a Free Commonwealth and the Excellence Thereof Compared with the Inconveniences and Dangers of Readmitting Kingship to this Nation. Well, it's all in vain, because Charles, who became Charles II, is duly restored to his throne in the spring of 1660, and the church hierarchy almost immediately afterwards. And of course, we've still got them. A warrant for Milton's arrest was issued in June. His books were publicly burnt by the common hangman in August. And if the Act of Free and General Pardon had not been passed at the end of that month, it is virtually certain that the world would be without Paradise Lost. As it was, the imposition of a draconian licensing act in 1662 brought to an end the relative freedom of the press, so that although Milton lived on for another 14 years, in which he wrote some of his greatest poetry, he was never able to publish any further political works, nor indeed was any radical thinker after 1662 until the expiry of the licensing act in 1695. So Milton's writings as a political philosopher are confined entirely to this particular period, 1640 to 1660. And I now want to address myself specifically to those years and to this body of work. Well, as we've seen, Milton was concerned during these revolutionary decades with many different themes. But there are recurring preoccupations. And I want in particular to show, as the title of this lecture declares, that one of these was the question of human freedom. Indeed, I want to go much further. I want to put it to you that as a theorist of politics, it is with the question of human freedom that Milton is at all times principally concerned. Milton himself tells us in his last political tract, The Ready and Easy Way, that he has been concerned throughout with two distinct elements in what he calls the whole freedom of man. One of these he describes as civil liberty, and the other as religious liberty. And he considers and reconsiders these elements in all his political tracts. And in each instance, I think it would be fair to say, and this is certainly how the discussion has gone, it looks as if what he wants to tell us about political freedom in particular is relatively a familiar story. To be free, he repeatedly says this, requires that you should be able to act as you choose without being forcibly prevented from acting, or else forcibly compelled to act in some way other than as you choose. As he summarizes at the end of the tenure of kings and magistrates, I quote, "To have power to act and dispose according to your will is to possess that power which is the root and source of all liberty." If, therefore, you're to count as being in possession of your religious liberty, the first element, you must be able freely to follow the promptings of conscience. That's the key notion. You mustn't be subject to any oppressive demands from either the church or the state. And that's what's laid down at the outset of the Treatise of Civil Power in Ecclesiastical Causes. I quote, "The upholding of Christian freedom requires that for belief or practice in religion, according to conscientious persuasion, no one ought to be punished or molested by any outward force on earth whatsoever." So from the beginning, notice, Milton is presenting himself to us as a radical independent in matters of faith. That's to say, he's no less hostile to the notion of the Erastian control of the church by the state than he is to the notion of an established church. He rejects both, root and branch, in the name of conscience. Conscience alone decides. In a similar way, the possession of civil liberty is said to require that we should be able to pursue our chosen ends without any unnecessary coercion on the part of the state. And that's the commitment that Milton most celebratedly defends in his attack on press licensing when the freedom of the press was threatened in 1643, his Areopagitica of 1644. The affront to liberty for Milton constituted by this form of censorship, that's to say the pre-publication licensing of all printed material, arises from the fact, and I quote, that there must, as a matter of natural right, be the liberty to know, to utter, and to argue freely according to conscience above all liberties. So, in short, according to Milton, the possession of freedom, whether civil or religious, and those two categories exhaust the idea of human freedom for Milton, requires that you should not be interfered with, compelled, or coerced in pursuit of your chosen ends. Whenever you are threatened or forced or otherwise oppressed, you suffer a corresponding diminution of liberty. And that's the claim repeatedly made, first of all, about religious liberty in the Treatise of Civil Power. I quote, "Whenever we are forced by the magistrate in matters of faith, this takes away our liberty, which is the certain and the sacred gift of God, neither to be touched by him nor parted with by us." And the same claim is made about civil liberty, most of all in the concluding passage of the tenure of kings and magistrates. And I quote again, "Wherever a people falls subject to an unbridled potentate or tyrant, he will by force of arms endeavour their oppressing and thereby bereave them of their liberty." Notice that the loss is deathly. So it's not surprising, and this is how the issue is generally thought about, I think it would be fair to say, that Milton's vision of human freedom, whether religious or civil, has usually been understood simply as a plea that we should be minimally interfered with in the exercise of our rights. For example, this turns out to be our Prime Minister's view, which is always reassuring. As Gordon Brown made clear in a speech, a remarkable speech he delivered at the University of Westminster last October under the title On Liberty, or rather it's under John Stuart Mill's title On Liberty. I'm not sure if he knew that. Milton figures very prominently in Mr. Brown's text, in which he appears yoked with John Locke as a key proponent of the belief, and I quote, "that liberty essentially consists in everyone's having the freedom and space to live their lives by their own choices, free from the control and unjustified interference of others." Well, I think Locke would have been horrified to be yoked with Milton. But let that pass. The point I want to pursue is that to think of John Milton as a defender of the idea that freedom essentially, or even chiefly, consists in absence of interference is, I think, is a real anachronism. We have to think ourselves into a completely different mental world. It's a complete mistake. It's an anachronistic mistake, issuing from how we think about freedom now in our society, as I think those quotations from Gordon Brown's actually very impressive speech suggest. As far as I can see, the power of our rulers to limit our freedom of action by interfering with our choices is, according to Milton, only a symptom of a much deeper affront to freedom, to your freedom. And it's on the deeper affront, he thinks, that we must concentrate. And it's in the hope of uncovering what I think is Milton's much more complicated, and if I may say so, much more challenging understanding of human freedom, that I now want to focus specifically on this aspect of his work. Milton's phraseology repeatedly makes clear that his fundamental concern is not with freedom of action, and thus absence of interference with action, at all. That's not his primary concern, freedom of action. Although it usually is ours when we talk about freedom. Rather, his basic concern is with a question which we tend not to ask, but it is his question, as he puts it, at the outset of the tenure of kings and magistrates, which is, what does it mean to be a free person? What does it mean to be a free person? And to live as a free person in a free state? I quote him in full flood. "No one can be so stupid as to deny that all men are naturally born free, or to suppose that such free persons would ever voluntarily give away this birthright of liberty and subject themselves to the dominion of a lord and master. And this, too, is his basic preoccupation in his final political tract, The Ready and Easy Way of 1660, in which he contrasts the rule of King Charles I, under whom the people of England forfeited their liberty, he was a tyrant, with the rule of the Parliament, I quote, which acknowledged that the people of England are a free people, and they themselves the representatives of that freedom. So it seems to me the key question is, what does it mean to be a free person? Well, Milton has quite a simple answer to that, and he indicates it in many passages. You are a free person if and only if you are in possession of a particular status. Freedom is not about actions, it's about a status. And the status you must possess is that of fully being a citizen. And the contrast is with being a slave. Now, as Milton himself says, this understanding of freedom is essentially and originally juristic. And he draws attention to this fact in a very early entry in his commonplace book, which you can still see in the British Library, his account of his reading. Ask for it. It's wonderful. Well, they won't be glad if you do, but it's rather precious. As early as 1640, he writes in his commonplace book, if we want to understand the idea of liberty, we must read the account of freedom and servitude in the Roman law. Well, in the early modern period, that's what everybody did. And if you duly turn to the outset of the Roman law and to the opening rubric, De statu hominum, concerning the status of men and women, then what you get, and I quote, and obviously I'm translating, is the fundamental division within the law of persons is that all men and women are either free or they are slaves. And there then follows a formal definition of slavery. Slavery is an institution of the jus gentium by which somebody is, contrary to nature, subject to the dominion of someone else, and hence in potestati, as the law says, in their power. We speak still of being in someone's power. So that in turn yields you a definition of what it is to be a liber homo, a free man or woman. If everyone in civil associations is either bond or free, then a free person must be someone who is not subject to the dominion of anyone else. To be a free person, and thus to be in the fullest sense a citizen, is to be able to act according to your autonomous will in consequence of not being dependent upon the will, or as we would say, upon the goodwill of anyone else. Now, that understanding of freedom was also held in Roman antiquity to carry with it very important constitutional implications. And we're seeing a picking up of Roman antiquity in English 17th century radicalism here. Because, of course, the Romans were republicans, and so was Milton. The constitutional implication had already been fully explored by the Roman historians, especially Livy and also Tacitus, long before the codification of the law at the end of the imperial age. Already in Livy and in Tacitus, a free person is the civis, is the figure of the citizen. That's to say, someone who is active in consenting to and indeed making the laws by which they are bound. And the crucial constitutional implication, which is fearlessly drawn by Livy at the beginning of Book Two of The Great History, is you cannot live as a free person under a monarchy. That's not possible. Why? Because all monarchs have what we would call prerogative powers, which are arbitrary. That's to say, they are under the arbitrium, the mere will of the monarch. But to live under the arbitrary will of anyone else is to live in dependence upon their will. And that is the condition of the slave. So it follows that if you wish to be a free person, free man or woman, you can only be this person if you live in a republic. There's the drama of the claim that they wish to put, they wish to revive. That you are free if and only if you live in a free state. That's to say, a state in which the laws are entirely enacted by your will. It may be a represented will, but it must reflect your will, and in which only the laws rule. There is no prerogative power at all. Now, what you can see I want to argue is that it's essentially this Roman vision of freedom and free persons that Milton takes up in his major political treatises, and above all, in the tenure of kings and magistrates. At the climax of that work, he finally asks whether the people of England have the right to put their king on trial for his life. And Milton's answer is that unless they have that right, they cannot be said to have the independent power to govern themselves according to their own will. But if they lack that power, then they are not free persons living in a free state at all. I quote, "They may please their fancy with a ridiculous and painted freedom fit to cozen babies, but they are under tyranny and servitude, living in the tenure and occupation of an inheriting lord whose government, even if not illegal or intolerable, hangs over them as a lordly scourge, not as a free government, and is therefore to be abrogated." Well, these commitments are, I think, best summarized in the Iconoclastes, which, as we've seen, Milton published later in the same year, in 1649. He goes through Charles I's narrative of his mistreatment, as Charles saw it, at the hands of his own parliament, chapter by chapter. And so he comes in chapter 11, to the point where King Charles I had made his final offer to Parliament of a constitutional settlement in June 1642, immediately before the outbreak of the shooting war, which of course had been a verbal war for 2 years by then. And this was the King's answer to the 19 propositions, in which he accepted that England was a mixed monarchy, but in which he continued to insist that he must hold a range of prerogative rights, including the right, which was known as the negative voice, which is still technically present in our constitution, which is the right of the monarch to veto any legislation put to him. Now, what Milton does in the Iconoclastes is, at this point, to mount a vehement defense of the fact that Parliament repudiated and refused that constitutional settlement proposed by the Crown. It absolutely refused it. And Milton is saying, absolutely so. And why? Because, and then he gives you, it's a moving moment in the Iconoclastes, he steps back and says, well, what is a free state? What is it to be a free person in a free state? And here's his answer. "Every commonwealth is in general defined as a society sufficient of itself in all things conducible to well-being and commodious life. Any of which requisite things, if it cannot have, without the gift and favour of a single person, or without leave of his private reason or his conscience, it cannot be thought sufficient in itself, and by consequence no commonwealth, nor free, but a multitude of vassals in the possession and domain of one absolute lord. And if our highest consultations and purposed laws must be terminated by the king's will, then is the will of one man our law. And then no subtlety of disputation can redeem the Parliament and the nation from being slaves." Well, what I've so far tried to argue then is that Milton's primary concern in his discussion of civil and religious liberty is not with the question, what does it mean to be able to act freely, or what is a free action? Our questions in a liberal individualist society. His question is, what is it to be a free person? Now, that does not mean, of course, this would be an obvious non sequitur, that doesn't mean that Milton is uninterested in the question of free action, in the concept of being free to act and able to act freely. On the contrary, what I now want to try to go on to show you is that what deeply interests him is the relationship between whether or not you are a free person and whether or not you are able to act freely. That's a further theme that he now wants to take up. And the first thing to say here is, of course, he doesn't in the least dispute that your standing as a free person will be lessened or taken away if you are sufficiently seriously interfered with in the exercise of your choices. Indeed, to be a free person is to be able to act according to your autonomous will. So any actual interference with your will that prevents you from acting as you had chosen, of course, takes away your freedom, or limits it, or you forfeit it to some degree. He doesn't, of course, deny that at all. And so he frequently says things which are so familiar that the whole picture begins to look, as I want to say, too familiar. Too familiar because, of far greater importance to Milton is the fact that it is equally possible for your freedom of action to be curtailed, even if nobody subjects you to the least degree of interference. And the reason for that is that if you fall into a condition of dependence, your mere awareness of that predicament will in itself have the effect of limiting your choices. That's the claim. That sounds a really strange claim, I admit. And it's usually been dismissed as confused. But I don't think it's confused at all. I think it's a really crucial point which we tend not properly to grasp about the theory of freedom. And Milton grasps it beautifully. He is asking you to reflect on what will happen once you come to realize that you are living under the arbitrary power of somebody else. Whether it is, in our society, I don't know, a customs official, somebody at an airport, an abusive partner, or whatever it might be. As soon as you recognize that your condition is one of dependence upon their goodwill, that will be sufficient, this is Milton's point, for you to self-censor. It will be sufficient for you to decide to set limits to your own freedom of action. Because now that you have this awareness of your predicament, you're going to do everything, however abject, to minimize the risk that the master or the ruler, the person with arbitrary power, is going to intervene in your life in a detrimental way. And at the same time, you're going to take very good care to do nothing that might arouse this person's envy or rage or any other destructive passion of the soul. Now, those contentions, which I want to talk about a little more, because I think they're unfamiliar but crucial to any theory of civil liberty, are also classical in provenance, as most things are in the humanities. And again, we must look back to the Roman historians and above all to Sallust and to Livy, but in this case, most of all, to Tacitus, who summarizes it all. He has such a gift for summary in a mournful epigram when he says, "Slavery always brings slavishness." Sallust in the Catiline goes even further, stressing the baleful implications of the fact that rulers will tend to be especially envious and therefore liable to be enraged by their most gifted subjects. And the consequence, Sallust writes, this is at the beginning of the Catiline, where he talks already about Rome's decline as a republic, is that such subjects find themselves, citizens as they should be, find themselves condemned to curbing their most valuable talents for fear of what might happen to them if they were to exercise them too visibly. And that's one reason, according to Tacitus as well as Sallust, why the citizens of republics will always outperform the subjects of monarchies, and notice that distinction between being a citizen of a republic and a subject of a monarch. They will always outperform them in the glory of their deeds as well as in the originality of their thought. Why? Because kings prefer flatterers. They prefer time servers. Whereas in republics, the most creative spirits can soar unchecked by any craven anxieties. And a further reason, which Sallust adds, is that there are few civic duties to be performed under kings, with the result that their subjects readily slide, as Sallust puts it, into a state of lazy acquiescence. To which I'm afraid he also adds Asiatic obsequiousness. Now, Sallust and Tacitus are Milton's two favourite prose authors. No question of that. He twice uses the passage from Sallust I've already quoted as an epigraph on his political texts. And what Milton does is to take from Sallust and Tacitus this entire way of thinking. It's a very profound way of thinking, I think, about the psychology of freedom and servitude. You find him drawing on their insights in the Areopagitica, which I've already mentioned, of 1644, in which he speaks about the visit he made. Milton made a long visit, the Grand Tour, to France and above all to Italy between 1637 and 1639. And 1638 finds him in Florence, where he met Galileo, the aged prisoner of the Inquisition. And in Florence also found both the scientists and the literati so frightened of what might happen to them if they were to publish their ideas that they very much preferred to remain safely silent. Because look what has happened to Galileo, and he doesn't yet know what might happen to him. He's being forced to live as a slave. Here is Milton. Actually, it's quite easy to distinguish Milton's prose from mine, but I will keep saying it. I was counted happy to be born in such a place of philosophical freedom as they supposed England was, while themselves did nothing but bemoan the servile condition into which learning amongst them was brought, that this it was which had damped the glory of Italian wits, that nothing had been written there now these many years but flattery and fustian. Now, it's this dismal truth, this Tacitian truth, that everyone is prone to self-censorship in the face of arbitrary power, which is one main reason why Milton, in the ready and easy way, confronts with such disgust the impending restoration of the English monarchy. Because, I quote, "We shall see flatteries and prostrations. We shall see the perpetual bowings and cringings of an abject people. We shall not look for noble words or actions, frank judgments or upright lives." That's monarchy. And notice the crucial pun there. A free person is upright. That's to say, they look you in the eye. They are not courtiers or placemen who stoop. They bend the knee. Never trust anyone who creeps. But that's, of course, a deep point in Milton, because serpents creep. Well, Milton says, "I can scarce believe that the people of England are about to make themselves slaves of a single person in this way, after 10 or 12 years, prosperous war and contestation with tyranny, basely and besottedly, to run your necks again into the yoke which you have broken, and prostrate all the fruits of victory for naught at the feet of the vanquished, besides our loss of glory and such an example to kings or tyrants never yet had the like to boast of, will be an ignominy if it befall us that never yet befell any nation possessed of their liberty, worthy indeed themselves whatsoever they be, to be forever slaves." Nevertheless, the ignominy was incurred, and within a few years Milton seems to have felt that the still worse consequence of living under arbitrary power that Sallust had described had likewise come to pass. You remember Sallust saying, there's a further fear, which is that in course of time, servility comes to be enjoyed with ease. Nothing is demanded of you. Of course, you're not a free person, but you're left alone to luxuriate. And people begin to prefer that to a strenuous life of civic engagement, which is the life of the Republic. So this is the deepest corruption that monarchy imposes upon you, that it withdraws from you your citizenship, and you cease to care. I must say, it seems to me that in Samson Agonistes, I mean, I know I'm here making an important claim about the dating of that great work, which is contentious, but it seems to me it must be a post-restoration poem, in part, at least, because it so much brings up this very specific theme. And I'm thinking in particular of the moment when the enslaved Samson, after all, blind and enslaved and at the mill with slaves, when he meditates on Judah's failure to take part in a flight for deliverance. This is my first quotation from Milton's verse. "Had Judah that day joined, or one whole tribe, they had by this possessed the towers of Gath and lorded over them whom now they serve. But what more oft, in nations grown corrupt and by their vices brought to servitude, than to love bondage more than liberty, bondage with ease than strenuous liberty." Well, let me round off this part of my argument by underlining the fact that the sole question I've been seeking to raise here is, what does it mean to Milton to possess your freedom? Well, it separates into your civic freedom and into your religious freedom, but essentially what it means is to be a free person. What I have not asked, notice, is a categorically different question, which is, who ought to be free persons? who ought to be allowed the exercise of the freedoms that are characteristic of free persons, that's to say, the autonomous direction of their own will. Now, it must be said that if you ask that further question, you do confront the limitations of Milton's intellectual sympathies. And these limitations were the commonplaces of his day, but we are very sentimental about Milton, I'm afraid. And they will disappoint those who like to think of him as an absolutely unqualified defender of human freedom. So I hereby disappoint Mr. Brown. When Milton refers in the Treatise of Civil Power to liberty of worship, he eloquently pleads for it on behalf of all the sects, all the dissenting sects. But of course he doesn't plead for it on behalf of the Roman Catholic community. Indeed, he thinks they should be subject to extremely strong penalties, to say nothing of other religious faiths. And when he similarly refers in Areopagitica to liberty of expression, it's very important to understand, because that's always said to be a great text about freedom of speech. It is not a text about freedom of speech at all. It is a text about how there should not be a right of a licensor to license or refuse to license publications intended for print in advance of their being printed. That's what Milton opposes. He does not oppose penalties for printing seditious or scurrilous works. And the number of works that Milton would have thought scurrilous would actually have been extremely large. And they would have been subjected to severe penalties. So it is not a plea for freedom of speech. It is a plea for freedom of licensing of the press. So you have to admit that although freedom is, I'm trying to show you, the central value for Milton, the question who should be allowed to exercise it is one where he wishes to insist it is never remotely an unrestricted right. Now, there are 10 minutes remaining to you, if I still have your patience, and I hope I do, because surely I cannot end without saying a word about Paradise Lost. Good. And I want to do so because this is a further text in which the concept of human freedom is absolutely at the heart of the argument, especially in Book 3. In which it's an amazing discussion in Book 3 when the authorial voice speaks out in favour of the concept of the freedom of the will. After all, Milton, a radical Puritan, and the whole Calvinistic background insisting on double predestination, everyone is predestined either to salvation or not, and no actions of yours are other than predestined. Milton speaking in favour of the doctrine of the freedom of the will, and thus, and this is why it's critical, of course, to the whole organisation of the great poem, of Adam and Eve's disobedience as not a predestined act, it is a freely chosen act. That's utterly crucial to the way in which the epic mutates into a tragedy. Without that freedom, there is no tragedy. It is true, of course, that God has complete foreknowledge of what will happen, but that is not the same as saying that it is preordained. And God speaks, "I formed them free, and free they must remain till they enthrall themselves." Now, besides this theological commitment, Milton in Paradise Lost is much concerned, again, with what it means to be a free person, to be able to live freely. And he reverts to that question intensively in the opening two books. It's a major theme of the opening two books, isn't it? But if you now turn to those passages, you find yourself confronting something which all readers of the poem have been deeply disconcerted by, who know anything about Milton's prose works, which is that the language in which Milton had previously vindicated the cause of the English Republic, that's to say, the language of freedom and not vassalage, of hard liberty instead of lazy servility, of an upright life and not the bended knee, this is the language spoken by Satan and his most hellish confederates. Perhaps most disconcerting is the moment when the figure of Mammon, when we're in pandemonium, you remember, in the beginning of Book 2, speaks in the debate. It's a kind of university disputation which the fallen angels conduct about whether they should renew the war in heaven. Moloch speaks in favour, but Mammon then proposes that they should go their own way. But what he proposes is that they should establish in hell just the kind of free and industrious commonwealth that Milton so much admired on earth. I quote,
"How wearisome,
eternity so spent in worship paid to whom we hate. Let us then not pursue by force impossible, by leave obtained unacceptable, though in heaven, our state of splendid vassalage, but rather seek our own good from ourselves, and from our own live to ourselves, though in this vast recess, free, and to none accountable, preferring hard liberty before the easy yoke of servile pomp." Well, fixing on those and other similar passages, an influential strand of commentary associated in particular with the great name of William Empson has claimed to discern in the poem an element of uncontrolled hostility on Milton's part towards the god whose ways he had assured us in the very opening of the poem he planned to justify to men. I do not myself see Milton's unconscious so uncomplicatedly seizing control in these and other admittedly troubling passages. Satan is shown, I agree, confronting his catastrophic loss with great fortitude and with great determination, and both of those can be great virtues. But it's surely very just a toad, as he first presents himself as. He doesn't present Eve with the possibility of the greatest tragedy that there ever has been. So you have to see him as formidable. And furthermore, we have to be careful in speaking about the place of monarchy in Milton's thought. He undoubtedly believes, I've tried to show this evening, that earthly monarchies inevitably violate the proper relations there should be between all of us. They violate those relations because they turn us from free persons, which is our nature, into slaves. And he makes it very clear in the ready and easy way that he thinks it ridiculous that kings and queens, who are ordinary mortals, often very boring ones, who are there by an accident of birth, should be treated with, as he says, fawning adoration and pomp. This is ridiculous. And he also thinks that such obsequiousness is very bad for those who stoop to it, because it helps them to forget what is the most important truth of all, which is that we are all created free as well as equal in the sight of God. However, there is no violation of how things should be if we show absolute deference and obedience to God as opposed to some mortal person. And in Book 5, that's precisely what the angel Abdiel says in response to Satan's outburst. We should not want to challenge God because our bonds with God should be bonds of love. But in any case, we cannot hope to challenge him because God is omnipotent, and there is no evading the fact that in relation to God, we are slaves. "Shalt thou give law to God?" This is Abdiel speaking to Satan. "Shalt thou give law to God? Shalt thou dispute with him the points of liberty, who made thee what thou art and formed the powers of heaven, such as he pleased?" Well, having said all that, though, it does seem to me that it remains very striking, to say the least, that Milton's most powerful attack on monarchy, which Milton sees as a demeaning form of government, especially for virtuous citizens, should be placed, as it is, in the mouth of Satan, in this thrilling passage I want to read you from Book 5. "But what if better counsels might erect our minds and teach us to cast off this yoke? Will ye submit your necks and choose to bend the supple knee? Ye will not, if I trust to know ye right, or if ye know yourselves, natives and sons of heaven possessed before by none, and if not equal all, yet free, equally free, for orders and degrees jar not with liberty, but well consist. Who can, in reason then, or right, assume monarchy over such as live by right, his equals, or can introduce law and edict on us, who without law are not, much less for this to be our Lord, and look for adoration to the abuse of those imperial titles which assert our being ordained to govern, not to serve. Well, perhaps in that and similar passages, there really is some ambiguity, I think, in Milton's response to the monarchy of heaven, especially if you reflect that for Milton, what God is simply omnipotent will, that's to say, pure arbitrariness to which you cannot but be subjected. Because what I want to end here by saying is that what Milton seems, I think, even in the poem, and unquestionably in all of the prose that I've quoted, what he seems most to want us to recognize is that all lawful government must be self-government. That if we are to count as free persons, then any government over us must be government by us, not by anyone else. So perhaps Milton really was, as Blake put it in his celebrated formula, of the devil's party without knowing it. Thank you very much.